We'd like to thank our sponsor for this episode, ViewRail,
America's leading manufacturer of floating stairs and modern cable glass railings.
They handle every part of the process, from design, engineering, manufacturing, delivery, all the way to installation.
There is a 10-year structural and finish warranty on all products installed by a ViewRail certified technician.
Nearly all components are made in-house, giving you more control over style, material, finishes, budget, and timeline.
All products are designed as a modular, integrated system that are engineered for easy installation. It's like putting together an erector set.
Thanks so much again, ViewRail, for sponsoring this episode.
We want to say thank you to our sponsor, Benjamin Opdyke, for sponsoring this episode of Passion for Craft.
It's time to think differently about our roof construction. Vapor Dry SA is not your grandpappy's underlayment. It provides a fully sealed roof deck that is permeable, allowing trapped moisture to escape while it seals every fastener.
Used in conjunction with Cedar Breather roof mat, allowing a fully ventilated space for cedar, metal, and cold roof applications.
It can replace traditional adhered products in valleys and eaves to protect from ice damming.
It's extremely durable and walkable, approved for an all high temperature environments.
Thanks so much again to Benjamin Opdyke for sponsoring this episode.
Check out the description for a build show sample kit.
All right, welcome back to the Passion for Craft podcast. Today we've got one of my classmates as our guest. We've got Kevin Jarvis here. Do you want your full name given?
Yeah, I don't
want
that's a totally
social
fine.
Security
no,
number.
Yeah,
okay,
sure.
Credit cards. Yeah, exactly. So Kevin is someone who walked into the door at North Bennett Street and said, you know, hey, I'm a listener of the podcast. I follow your dad. That's one of the reasons why I'm actually here and why I'm in this program. And so, you know, the more we've gotten to learn about Kevin and you kind of learn more about everyone who's in your class and everyone's skills kind of come out and you hear more about their story. And so from what I know about Kevin, and you're going to fill in the gaps here, Sure. Is you are a cabinet maker.
Yep.
And you were trying to elevate your game. And I heard you say that and I was like, awesome. That's like why you're here.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
Do you want to just tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got on this journey? And, you know, I know you didn't start as a craftsman. That wasn't your first.
Where are you from?
Maybe it was.
From Lowell.
Lowell, Mass.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. 20 miles north.
Okay.
Yep. Well, thank you guys for having me.
Yeah.
This is really exciting to be here. So I guess I'll start way back. I mean, childhood? I don't know.
Sure.
No.
If it applies.
What does your dad do?
Dad is in education. But he was always making stuff, tinkering, doing housework. And I guess if I started way back then, you know, I should be grateful my folks always allowed me to make stuff, tinker around. So I think that set it from a very early age. It was 2012. I took a course here, Fundamentals of Fine Woodworking, something like that.
Hmm.
And that changed a lot of stuff. Up until then, I was always just doing, you know, hobby work stuff in the basement, really crude stuff. And that showed me what was possible, right? Because we took a plane.
This is a continuing education class at North Ministry.
Yeah, great class. And so we took, it was the fundamentals of literally everything. We took tools, fixed them up, kind of like we're doing now.
Yeah.
It opened a door that allowed me to see, you know, it showed a whole different perspective of craftsmanship. And so I took that and just bettered my game on the hobby level. And then in 2015, I got trained as a cabinet maker, I guess by contemporary standards, at a school that's no longer open in Western Mass, New England School of Architectural Woodworking. Really great school. It was after that I went into commercial cabinetry, which we definitely don't need to talk about that. It's fast work, high turnover. You know, schools and institutions, especially hospitals, they change their cabinetry over quite regularly just for, you know.
So you're doing pressure laminate stuff?
Lots of laminate, reception desks, things like that, yep. And that was really unfulfilling. Not much craft in that. So I started going out on my own after that into residential and doing pretty basic work. Your standard kitchen cabinets. 4-inch toe kick. I would do inset doors. That was about as fancy as I could get.
Yeah.
And you just still unfulfilled, thirsty for more. I knew there was more out there, but I didn't really know what.
Yeah.
Fast forward, I ended up joining the Navy. So I was there for 4 years. And I still did a lot of handwork. That 4 years of doing nothing but hand tools really changed my game. You know, it had to focus on a different way of thinking, different way of woodworking.
Wait, you did? You worked with hand tools in the Navy?
I did. So in between deployments, things like that, breaks, weekends, I would just make projects for the home, stuff like that. After getting out of the Navy, came back home, and it was like, all right, I'm going to get back into woodworking. I knew that. Got back into cabinetry, residential cabinetry, rebuilt the shop. And on that note, what I ended up doing was I got old machines. Like, we're talking 1890s, 1910.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah, old cast iron. Fixed them all up. That was a massive learning curve. It offered, I think when you build your own tools and you fix machinery, I think you can learn a lot as a craftsperson.
Yeah.
You learn the ins and outs of what it is you're actually doing on a whole different level.
So you have Babbitt bearings and stuff?
I re-poured 4 Babbitt bearings this summer. I updated the square cutter heads to helical heads. Yeah, so I got those custom made for the machines and had to learn how to re-pour Babbitt. And so that's something I have in my pocket now.
So what is Babbitt? What does that mean?
Babbitt's one of the oldest bearings, types of bearings, I think, that exists. And it's basically...
So like steel ball bearings?
No, not ball bearings. You heat up this, what was traditionally lead, antimony, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correct, antimony, something like that. And then copper or something similar. You melt it and essentially pour it around your... shaft. Mandrel or the shaft, preferably a mandrel, something sacrificial. They still use them in industrial applications, high speed and things like that. So anyways, did that.
The shaft kind of spins in a metal, in a oil bath kind of sit there.
Exactly, yeah.
And so it's
cool.
Yeah, I had a machine out of Babbitt bearing.
They're great. If you take care of them, keep them oiled, they'll last, for a lifetime.
Wow.
Yeah, really, really nice stuff. And so got the shop set up. And I was just in a total kind of loss of what exactly to focus on.
Yeah.
I was like, well, I'm not fulfilled with the cabinetry I left.
That being commercial.
Commercial and just your basic run-of-the-mill cabinetry. They're a dime a dozen. Just totally unfulfilling. Mm-hmm. And
were you a one-man shop?
One-man shop, yeah.
So did you use Cabinet Vision or did you draw that stuff up yourself?
No. SketchUp was this a little AutoCAD, actually, but that jumped off that fast. I'm not very...
So you're doing kitchens for people, baths, just whatever they wanted?
Yeah, exactly. There was a GC that would hire me for, he would sub me out for what he would consider a little bit higher end type work. Again, that fitted inset doors, things like that.
How did you bid stuff?
As far as...
Did you bid it by the foot? Did you bid it by just the task? How long you thought it was going
to
take?
Yeah, it'd be by the job. Because they were never large enough to where it was, I never got into a by the foot pricing. It wasn't standardized. I never had a standardized, way of doing things. And it'd probably be good if I did, I suppose. But yeah, so it was in between a lot of not really knowing what to do. It was around that time, too, that I learned about just the golden ratio and proportions. And I knew there's something I couldn't quite understand it. It's a whole world that I was excited to get into.
Yeah.
Didn't really know how to begin or how to apply it, really, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
But I knew there was something else. And so... I'm like, I'm trying to figure out what to do. Do I want to do furniture? Do I want to do shaker furniture? Do I want to do rocking chairs, cabinetry? Like, I didn't really know what to do. And I remember I was looking up, I think I was doing a Dutch door for a developer. And I think I was trying to find something very specific about the way the muntins meet the profile, the sticking on the door. I was looking up something like that, maybe a window. But I typed in this very specific search about this historical-based way of doing it. And Brent, one of your videos popped up. I'm like, all right, let me see what
this is
about.
Sorry about that.
I should thank you.
Do you know what video? I know Austin is curious what video it was.
I will find, I mean...
If you find it, it'd be kind of funny to know.
I could probably go through the history.
It'd be fun to find out.
This was a couple years ago.
Yeah, okay.
And that just, I watched that video and I was just like totally taken back. I never heard somebody articulate exactly what I was trying to say so well. And I realized at that point, okay, something else exists. There's a whole world of building that exists that people are pushing for. It just changed everything. And then you mentioned the North Bend Street School. And I said, holy cow, there's got to be a connection here. And up until that point, I was thinking about doing the cabinet furniture program, which would have been great and fine, but I think I ultimately made the correct decision. Yeah. And so, to say that you influenced it would be an understatement. So yeah, fast forward, here we are at the school now.
What's the hope?
I have 2 years to really think about this. Casework in cabinetry is always going to be a big part of what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to do historic millwork. I would like to do windows, proper windows, curved moldings. I want to be the guy who people know to go to for this type of work that's not just, you know, we don't want flex molding. Mm-hmm. We want the real thing, right? But also with like casework, stuff like that. I'm interested to hear your experience with casework because I don't want to just take on any job. I want to be able to learn how to, I guess, educate, influence, maybe present a whole different perspective to clients using the classical system mm-hmm. and something with historic precedent. That, you know, you go into a 1900s bungalow, I want to be able to say, well, look, there's a running theme here. Why don't mm-hmm. we use these things from the past and at least kind of tie it in, make it look appropriate.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's been kind of the plight is this education kind of convincing or at least offering something else, you know, to the client.
Do you think you will own your own business?
Yes.
So you already do, right?
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
And so will it be, you know, you and a couple guys or will it always be you doing it yourself?
I'd like to scale it up, I think, a little bit. Yeah. I think that would be the practical approach. I don't want to be slinging, you know, 90 pound sheets of plywood forever. But yeah. I think for efficiency's sake, it would make sense. And another huge thing is painting, installation and painting. If there's two things that I would like to change, it's I would love to get to the place where I could build, do the millwork, do the casework, whatever it is, send it out, know there's a crew that's going to install it appropriately, mm-hmm. and then finish it, whether it's on-site or off. That's been a huge problem, especially with keeping flow, keeping jobs going, is finishing and installation, you know, so.
Do you feel like there's not very good installers out here?
You know what? I have no experience with subbing out installation. I'm sure if they had plans to follow, they could do it totally mm-hmm. fine. I don't see why not. As far as finishing goes, I have realized there's a distinct line between painters and finishers.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't want to make anybody mad out there, but I think there's great painters, but the difference being the final feel, look, fit and finish of your paintwork, it's the icing on the cake. Mm-hmm. And whether you're spraying it or brushing it, you know, there's a series of steps to follow. And I've had two experiences where somebody else has painted my work and they've been bad. It's mm. it's just textured finish, just kind of a get in, get out kind of job. And that's
I feel like that's true with a lot of trades. They that they just blow and go. I'm curious, you know, now that you've been here, what, a couple months?
Yeah, 2 months.
I mean, it sounds like you had there was a hole in your learning or something that was going on there that have you rounded out what was missing or have you kind of figured out, you know what I wasn't doing this? Because I mean, certainly you have a very earnest approach to building and craft, feeling like there was something missing. I'm just curious if you have defined that now.
Yes, I think that's layout, design and layout, you know, approaching a blank canvas with the type of stuff we're learning here and the type of stuff you talk about. So being able to look at a potential job and know that I'm not just defaulting to, you know, if somebody has a alcove and they want a built-in, I don't want to just default to, you know, this standard kitchen cabinet type approach and have this 4-inch toe kick. And you know what I mean? It just look, I want to have a rhyme and a reason and this historic precedent to it and understand that there's a deliberate thought and layout to this, scale, proportion, everything. So that was a huge, huge link missing.
So more design than actual craft?
Yeah, well, it's definitely both. I feel good as far as the technical skill goes. I'm not saying there's not room to improve. There absolutely is.
No, you're being humble. You're a really skilled craftsman.
Thank you.
One of the reasons I thought you'd be a really good guest is because I think you're like a journeyman, you know, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, so like, so where I kind of had these own self-imposed, just these the principle that I said I wouldn't compromise on is things like joinery. So my built-ins and stuff, any doors that are larger than just your standard cabinet door, they're all Morrison tenoned. And so the problem I run into, I guess, is explaining that to the, like, there is no other option. I don't have that is the default. Mm-hmm. You know, so I just did the last ones I did was these 7 or 8 foot high built-ins, you know, 20 foot run. And it was like, you know, they're all Morrison tenoned. Things took a little longer, especially as a one-man shop. But mm-hmm. getting people to understand that the default is still higher than what you get somewhere else. But in the long run, it pays off, right? Yeah. The doors probably won't warp and move as much or, you know, the stability's there, the longevity's there. Mm-hmm. If it's worth building, it's worth building well.
It's interesting that design, you feel like design was your missing piece. And it's interesting that you're finding that solution at a school like North Ministry. People ask me all the time on my videos, why don't architects know this? Why don't designers know this? Who could have designed this? What were they thinking? And, you know, I'm explaining to people all the time, I'm not an architect. They assume that I am. And so I think it takes a place like this that studies the past, that looks at the old ways of building, that where you can learn that stuff, because I do feel like it's a lost art. I do feel like we've forgotten how to build. So it's interesting that's what you're finding as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I wanted to ask your thoughts on, you know, standardization of craft folk in America. There's so much accessibility to tools on the market, pocket hole things and, you know, chop saws. Anybody can get this stuff and call themselves a builder. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people that I've worked for got fooled by that. There's a lot of repair work and things going on. And so, you know, I know other parts of the world have a standardization where there's an entry-level kind of competency exam or certification you have to have. Whether that's good or bad, I'm not the one to say, but what do you think about that? Do you think there should be some kind of baseline?
For craftsmen?
For craftsmen, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't remember saying it to Robert or Steve, but, you know, the problem today is that you can be a craftsman but not know if you're good or not.
Sure.
And there is no standard like you're talking about that says I can do these eight tasks. That means I'm a level, you know, four carpenter, something. I'm making these things up.
Yeah.
But it's what Dan Parrish talked about on this podcast about that he is, because there's no system, he's oriented and built a system in his shop, which we're now trying to implement in ours, of a standard. You know, these skills, you get paid this much. You're this good. And it's been sad for me because I've met a lot of really good craftsmen and carpenters who are lost out there because they don't know, like you're saying, what's next. They don't know, you know, what am I missing? You know, what do I know? What I don't know? I feel like I'm missing some stuff, but you know, where do I find that information? And so, yes, there should be, and I wish, you know, in some respects, you look at what union carpenters do and their standardization, which maybe you can speak to. But that you know, there is more organization than there is just out there in the building world. And it may be more prevalent here up in New England than in Texas, because in Texas it's just there is no standardization.
It is kind of interesting just hearing, like when I heard Dan Parrish's deal where he was like, oh, we've got a level three carpenter who can do this at this speed, like this amount of sticks per minute, or I don't know. He had like some formula to it. It was like an oh my gosh moment of like, why does everyone not do this? Or why do we not have, it really made me go, why are we missing, why don't we have a guild system again? Like, why don't,
right.
We need to bring something like that back.
Or sure.
There needs to be that standardization so you know,
right.
Hey, this is what I'm missing in my skill set. Like,
right.
it seems like you're like, I know the holes kind of, but I don't know what goes in those holes necessarily. And
sure.
Like, I don't know. It's an interesting deal.
And you could be a great trim carpenter. You can be able to do a dead-on miter, right?
Yeah.
You could know all this stuff, but if you don't know what molding's going where and why, what good is that? And so, you know, I hope craftsmen don't take that as a challenge and get stuck in their ways and say, well, I don't need to change. It's like, you could be a great and highly skilled person, but you know, you should absolutely challenge yourself and understand that there's way more out there.
Yeah.
There's way more. No, you could be technically the best guy there is in your area, but unless you know why you're applying these things and where to do it.
When I wrote my book, The Timeless House in an Instant Age, there was a carpenter up in Kansas that I'm now good friends with, Travis, and he said that when he read the first three or four chapters, he was pissed at me because I was saying, you know, it's fine that you know how to cut a miter, but unless you know the moldings to put up, unless you know the why of what you're doing, that we're a how-to generation. We know how to, you can get on YouTube and learn how to do everything, but you don't know why you're putting those things up. You're just a monkey.
Right.
And so he didn't like that. And so, but by the time he got to the end of the book and understood what I was saying, he was like, yeah, no, I see what your point is. But we're how-to generation, and we don't know why we're putting those things up. We can assemble houses very fast, but our houses are ugly, our houses don't last long, our houses, you know, they're not sustainable, right? So you're just like, we're wasting time here, we're wasting our efforts.
Sure.
Now, I know you maybe had some questions specifically for Brent that have been burning. I thought, you know, one thing that might be helpful, not only for you, but even for some of the other journeymen and people out there who are yelling at their computer screens like, can you just tell me what this is? Or sure. I've always, you know, whatever. Yeah. I don't know if you had any questions about that. I know we could also talk about your business. We could have some fun trying to figure out like how you engage with clients or,
well,
I don't know.
Some of that is part of the question. Yeah, okay, it's just a lot of perspective stuff. You know, your experience with how to go about sharing this knowledge with your clients and some really technical things too, like painting. So if you're producing millwork that's going into either a historic home, new build, whatever it is, let's just say an existing home, and you're making a piece for it, do you default to spray finishes? What's your thoughts on spraying versus brushing?
I would rather everything be brushed.
Okay.
I don't mind if they want to spray the first coat, brush the second coat.
Sure.
But we like a brush finish.
And is that for casework, millwork, anything that's...
Pretty much anything.
Anything, yeah. Okay.
It's just a more handmade look than
I agree.
The plastic that looks like that you spray things with.
So, totally agree. And I know some people are going to be upset about it. And I think spray finishes, they, when done well, look perfect. And that's part of the problem, especially with millwork. If you put something in somebody's home, first of all, if they have, you know, existing millwork there and I put in casework, it just looks weird, butts up against it. It doesn't look right.
Hmm.
And it's way past the homeowner's ability to repair it. You know, should the dog scratch it or something fall on it, they can't touch that up.
Yeah.
You got to go back. You got to spray the whole thing again. You know, I think there's a place for spraying. I know it's fast. You know, when it comes to millwork, I do think it gives it direction, right? Like it says, this is where the rail meets the stile.
Mm.
It says, even if it's MDF, if you're using it, it says, well, this could be wood.
Mm.
You know, it gives direction.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And I mean, the problem is that with the automation of millwork from large factories, with the IKEA and the production cabinet companies, it begins to look like not wood, right? It begins to look like plastic or everything's MDF or vinyl.
It
or
feels
whatever
cardboardy
else.
Too.
It's
when
we
see the flat spray.
We have has done a number of closets for the last few jobs. And it's absolute crap.
Do we need to bleep that name that
maybe.
You just said?
It's just like, it is like a, it's just the worst constructed thing that I've ever seen. Sure. And I can't believe these $1 million houses that we're putting this stuff in there.
Right.
It's a joke.
Why are you putting it in? I guess is the.
This company, I won't say the name anymore, but they are a design led, okay, thing that will go into your closets and will help you organize stuff. So they have all these pull-down bars and these great drawer systems and all these different things so that your, you know, closet, master suite can look like a salon store, okay?
Yeah.
And so that's the look they're going for. But they have, you know, because the other thing that was happening is you would meet with the trim carpenter on this job and they'd say, well, I need this many feet of hanging, I need shoes, I need, and we would build all that in place. And so this is a little bit of a customization that they could get that they were really excited about. Right. But the quality is so bad, I don't think it lasts.
Is it the materials that's bad?
Yeah.
Or is it like, it's not how it's put together.
No, because they have lighting systems that are really, they look real sexy and everything. Right. But it's just the nuts and bolts, blocking and tackling, parts and pieces are junk.
Had you heard of this company that shall not be named?
Yes. I'm familiar with them. And again, it's... You know, I guess they're filling a need.
Hmm.
I'm not really sure. But kitchens too, even high-end kitchens now are not much different. Now, as far as automation goes, you know, if you have a CNC to cut out panels for your kitchen, like that's fine. There's nothing romantic about using a panel saw and cutting out plywood boxes. That's fine. But where all the magic happens on the face frame, the beaded face frames, inset doors, stuff like that, even the high-end kitchens today, they're just, there's a just seemingly void in how creative people are willing to get. It's even the high-end stuff is almost standardized, and I understand that it's efficient, probably smart for a business to have a flow, but you know, that's why if I do kitchens moving forward, like I want it to be for this revival home or you know, something where they really want a very peculiar look.
Well, the advice I would give to you, those talks I gave to you guys today, that understanding the classical system and then understanding historic precedent, I was talking to Steve about it. You know, he apparently had a story where a client was ready to tear the house down and he talked him into saving it. That happens to me all the time. That really? When I show up and I explain to them what their house is, when I explain to them what the opportunity really is, they're usually pretty excited about that because everybody else that goes in there is going, well, they just said we should tear all the windows out. Well, they just said we should tear this house down. Mm. Well, they just said the foundation's bad, so we can't keep it. And it's just, there's so much bad information being spread by builders that, you know, if
you need to build the next thing,
if you can go, yeah, really. And if you can go into there and explain to them, you've kind of alluded to it a couple of times, but be able to educate the client. Everything I do is educating the client. Everything I do. The reason I do videos, the reason I do Instagram and share all this stuff is to educate the client because people just don't know.
Hmm.
And, you know, the stuff you're learning, the problem is what happens is you get here and then you get into this, well, everybody knows that. And no one knows that.
Right.
And you're always teaching and educating and sharing.
How do you make that important, though? You know, how do you show them that it's you need to care about it?
Well, you're gonna end up attracting to yourself people that kind of give a shit, right? You're gonna attract people who care by the fact that you care, right? If you show up and the things that are coming out of your mouth are, you know, I can save you all kinds of money on this thing. Yeah, I did that. We saved them so much money. Mm. If those are the words that are coming out of your mouth, you're going to attract a client that all they care about is cost. But if you show up and say, you know what, really, for the quality of this house, we really need to do this kind of kitchen because this, and that means that we're going to do this kind of joinery. I'd like to use this kind of wood. I'd like that you're all of a sudden, you know, you're going to attract clients who care because there's clients out there who want that, who want, like I love my house. Like, what's the best thing I could do for my house? And you walk in there and you have that kind of conversation instead of, yeah, we'll blow this out. I'm going to save you all kinds of money, right? Those are two ends of the extreme. But you don't have to worry about how do I attract them, that long obedience in a similar direction. You're over time, you're going to attract those people that, hey, if you want this done right, you got to talk to Kevin, right? Sure. If you want this done well, he may be slow, whatever the negatives are, but it's done right, and we love it. Right?
And you've heard all the, he may be slow, he may be expensive, he may be
whatever. Thing that I get is that we're too expensive all the time. Like if I hear any kind of critique, it's just, he's so expensive. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we're still getting calls. We're still getting phone calls and because people want it right. And they see they're not that client that wants just the cheapest, fastest.
I feel like there is something also to the, like, I want the best. Like, I know just personally, if someone's like, yeah, you could get this one or you could get this one. And you're like, oh, well, I want the best one. But then you like kind of run it back in your head. You're like, no, I actually don't need that. But it does look pretty nice.
Well, like, there are clients out there that, and our clients have evolved to this point where money is not the obstacle. Okay. The money, that's not, they don't care. Right? Like if I said it's a $100,000 kitchen, okay, I was expecting $300,000, right? And you're like, yeah, shoot, I'm putting money on the table, right? And, but it's they don't, that's not their problem. That's not their challenge. Their challenge is they want something that's appropriate for the house, that's well-built, that's last for a long time.
Yeah.
They don't care. And so they're out there and they, and maybe if you put it like a tool, right, for us, like, well, you can go get a Buck Brother plane or a chisel, right, and spend $20.
Yeah.
Or you can go get a Lee Nelson or some, you know, whatever thing, sure, and spend $120. You don't care. You want the good tool, yeah, right? That's the way they feel about cabinets, right, or about their work that's going to have. That's not I care less whether it's $120. I want the best.
Right.
And it sounds like that's the kind you want.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing I realized too is well, I try to remind myself is it isn't my job to save you money and give you 100%. The best deal. If I know that I'm providing the best possible, you know, product that I can, you know, I'm not there to make sure that you can tell your friends you got a bargain, you got a deal. Mm-hmm. And that's easy to forget.
That's a huge deal.
Yeah.
It's a huge deal because so many guys feel like their role as a builder is to save the client money. And that's not why we're being hired.
Right. And I understand where you know, people come, you guys talk about, well, you know, I need the job, right? Mm-hmm. I need the money. I understand that. It's separate from the fact that you can keep challenging and pushing, and each job that you do, you could elevate it a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. As you're learning.
And you'll find clients that will see your passion and see your desire and be willing to, you've heard the term patrons, right? The people that come along that just have a bottomless bucket of money and just want what they want and let you experiment and play around. There are patrons out there who aren't rich, okay, but still want to promote craft. One of my first jobs getting out of North Bennett Street, I got back to Fort Worth, and they had this great historic house at Dilbeck, and we ended up restoring it 20 years later for this client, and they had just all kinds of repairs around this house that needed to be made. It was my second job. It was like I was looking for work and everything else.
Probably underqualified? Appropriately qualified?
Probably appropriately qualified, because it was just repair work. It wasn't like building an addition on the side of the house. And so they didn't have the money, but they loved what I was doing. They loved my passion. And they were just like, well, we weren't going to do this, but we want you to restore the whole screen-in porch. And so it was just, you know, rebuilding, restoring, building new wood, building a whole new screen-in porch. Wasn't a big job, but they were someone who loved the fact that I loved their house, loved the fact that I cared about quality and just wanted to hire me. So
they're excited because you're excited.
They're excited because I was excited.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, you don't have to worry. I mean, when you're just getting started, there are times in the first few years, okay, because it's going to take years, it's not months, that you are finding and develop a name. Sometimes you get lucky and you fall into one of those clients early on and they tell all their friends.
Yeah.
You know, and you get that kind of promotion. But
What do you feel like your base is?
I feel like I'm starting over in a sense, you know, because of school and like I've had experience before this, you know, I was working and some really great clients, but I feel like there's a whole new beginning coming up and I'm trying to look at it from that perspective, starting over, new direction, or at least more refined direction. Yeah, some really great clients. And I look back to my early work, and I wish I had that Men in Black pen where I could just totally vaporize it from my memory.
Do you feel like you had some pretty bad ones in there?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I think we all have those.
Just real cringy.
Your long-leaf yellow pine one, right?
Yeah. Things that maybe they look at it and they go, oh, it looks nice. But like at this point, you look back and you're just like, that's, you know. You never should have paid me for that.
Yeah.
I think one thing I would say is I think I would question whether you get back into cabinetry making.
Yeah.
I don't think there's that is such a cutthroat.
Oh, it's so tough.
Business. There's so many people doing it.
Yeah.
With less skill than you.
Yeah.
Less integrity than you. And bang it out and just, you know, it's too easy to build cabinets today. You're building boxes and putting a face frame on it. And then, you know, and so
is that something you're married to?
I would probably encourage you not to do that. Or if you are going to do it as a very high-end piece of your business. Like building architectural millwork, you've cut your, you know, the number of your competition by 80%, right? There's every guy and his dog can make cabinets. Not as many people can make doors and windows.
Hmm. Right.
And so, or to do, you know, paneled walls and to get into other parts of the house. I don't think I would encourage you to keep making cabinets.
So as a guy with a litany of cabinetry making materials, tools, machines, and everything like that.
A lot of those can be transferred over.
How does that feel?
I mean, it's sound wisdom. I think that's the sentiment expressed that I've been feeling. The thing is, like, you can walk into a multi-million-dollar home and you look at the kitchen and you're like, how, this doesn't match.
Yeah.
It doesn't look good. So if I could keep casework and kitchens specifically part of a bigger package, you know, I don't know if I'll ever be that big. I don't know. There's the whole road coming down of scaling. Like you guys mentioned before in another podcast, this plateau, it's nothing but small learning curves and then a massive plateau.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I have noticed.
Path of mastery.
Yeah, things are changing rapidly here, though.
You know? You feel like you're on that scale up, that big jump?
Yeah, well, at least I see what's in front of me to be able to expand a little bit. Yeah, for sure. And every little encounter, things like this, it just adds tremendous growth.
But what you just described when going into a million-dollar house and seeing a kitchen, you need to be able to describe and explain to your client why it's no good.
Yeah. Okay. That's actually a good point. So what do you do more often than not, I walk away from a potential client and they just look cross-eyed. They look dizzy. And I'm like, I just beat you to death with things that you'll never understand. Like, it's explaining a Morrison tenon to them could take more time, and they're just overwhelmed, and I can see them get fidgety, and I'm like, okay, I better back it off. We didn't even go over this. We didn't go over this. We didn't go over the nothing, right? Yeah. And it's like we got one part of a huge picture.
Yeah.
You know, and you need to catch your breath. So what do? You do mock-ups? Should I do mock-ups? Should I do small-scale things? You know, I don't know.
We do mock-ups for almost everything.
Yeah.
Because the client can't see it otherwise.
Are those out of foam, or do you do them out of wood and everything?
No, full.
Like small-scale.
Full scale.
Oh, wow.
Paneled wall. We did a, 12-foot paneled wall, just a 4-foot section, 12-foot tall. All the moldings, all the things we would use to show a client how we wanted to finish out a room.
And is that something that is that a gifted, or is it,
No, we asked them to pay for it. But we have a sample budget in our build project. So that we'll say, look, we've got $30,000 because we're going to make samples along the way. And like right now we're building three different door samples for a job. We just built some paneled wall samples that for the same thing. Just say, I need to show you what's in my head, and I can't just describe antique oak. I need to show you what antique oak looks like. Yeah. And so if it was the cabinet world, I would probably start by saying, just try to put it in context and say, look, most cabinets today are made with European hinges. European hinges were a hinge that was developed after World War II to make cabinets cheap and fast. If you look at cabinets before that time, you have inset doors. Yep. It was more furniture quality. My goal would be to get you towards that furniture quality. I don't want to build you something that's disposable.
Sure.
And so that's the way I would approach that. Without just the mortise and tenon joinery, I probably wouldn't try to describe that to them. I would probably tick it off as a thing and let them go back and look at it later.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you brought up a point that I wanted to ask about the European concealed hinges versus, a traditional butt hinge. What are your thoughts on those? I mean, I see the benefits of European hinges, use them all the time. I understand they're super adjustable, user-friendly. Yeah. So they're adjustable, but I've never seen some that didn't sag. I've never seen them not sag over time. They look like these big robotic arms coming out of your cabinetry, and there's people that are cursing me right now. I know it. But again, the skill it takes to set a butt hinge, scotch the hinge and have it, account for any gaps or anything that moves during installation. I think it takes a tremendous skill, and the time that it takes to do it only gets quicker because you get better at it.
Mm.
Things like that are tough though. And when I show that to people, sometimes it's kind of like, well, I don't want to see this break in the line or it looks like something from antiquity. And it's like, I can't just tell them it's better. They're like,
I would start by saying this is a 100-year, this is a 100-year hinge.
Take it from me.
This is a 10-year hinge.
Yeah.
And you will be replacing these in 10 years because they're going to sag. And it's just a temporary Band-Aid, and it's not long lasting. And it's not, it's cheap and fast.
Yeah.
But I mean, we have 3 or 4 samples of cabinets in our shop. We no longer build cabinets, but they're all inset doors, nothing overlay. And we are showing them with butt hinges and without, because we know some people don't like that fussiness of the butt hinge, even though I think that's a much better way to build.
Yeah.
And so, you can lead a horse to water, right? But you can't make them drink. Most of my conversations with clients, there comes a point where they say, just do it, right? You don't need to explain to me more. You don't need to sell me anymore. I understand that you're building better. Just do that. Yeah. Just do whatever you think. And so, which I've been doing this for 30 years, so it's taken a long time for me to get to that point. But they do finally realize that I'm trying to steer them towards what's better and long lasting, and they trust me now. And so... There has been when you're in the market long enough, that long obedience, you do build reputations, you do build trust. If there's a good traditional house being built in, Fort Worth, we're getting a call because that's what we do.
Sure. Now, when you guys were doing kitchens, were you doing 2K finishes? Were you brushing them on?
2K finishes.
Yeah, like the 2-part finishes. People swear by them. I understand they're factory finish, right? Super durable. It's a
No, we didn't do any. No, it was all taking raw cabinets to the job and then painting on site with painters on site.
Okay. Brush on like enamel or a...
Well, they got sprayed as a prime coat and then they got first coat and then final coat brushed.
Nice. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. Usually the insides were sprayed enamel or sprayed lacquer, clear finish. But we had a special cleat that was a shelf stay that we'd seen in a 1920s catalog that we liked. And so we didn't have any pegs or pins holding shelves up. It was just things like that.
So
that
no 32-millimeter system, none of that. None of that.
And so, so we were certainly bringing a better cabinet to market. But it was just, it was hard. It was, for the company that we wanted to build, building 100-year windows is much more satisfactory than, you know, banging out cabinets. And I would say banging out cabinets because that's kind of what you do.
It is. It is, isn't it? Yeah. Interesting.
Well, do you got any other burning questions that you want answered?
Oh, just talking shop is good. moving forward, you know, entryways, I'd like to do a lot of doors, things like that.
You should.
Yeah.
You should. Yeah, that's where you belong. I mean, I can tell that, you know, you're driven, right? You desire for precision and a desire for quality.
Sure.
And so, you know, you take that and what this place I think will do is expand your vision opportunity for what can be built.
Yeah.
And you're going to see things that are going to blow your, you know, socks off. And you know, It should be exciting and should be, you know, this desire to replicate some of these things.
Yeah.
And once you do that, I think you're not going to want to go back to the pre-hung door, the nail up door surrounds and things like that.
Yeah.
Which are disposable, right? So you're going to get into that better stuff.
And you're rocking the math today on a doorway. I mean, we're just looking at, you know, we're building these sheds right now, and so Steve just bought this. Like quarter sawn oak.
Yeah, ¼.
Yeah.
Quarter sawn white oak.
And we're for like doing the math on it. It's like for the 94 bucks.
Yeah, it worked out to be like 90 bucks for
one
each, for
threshold.
Each. And that's just the material. Yeah,
that's just
material.
It's not labor. It's not anything else. I mean, it sounds like you've got the math half done on how to go into your shop and build some doors up. But
Yeah.
God. Wait, I don't get it. What are you talking about?
Well, I'm just saying he's got an easy pivot ahead of him he's already starting to think, how could I go build this door profitably?
Well, there was things that translate, you know, from cabinet. I mean, you're thinking the same way. I think just like, again, if you're looking at a space, it's like, well, I have to subtract this scribe to the face frame, to the gap in the door, the styles, the width of the panel, all these things is just reverse, you know, measurements. You know, it's not too different.
I just saw you running the pricing costs. I'm like, well, he might already have a quote in his mind to go tell the next guy he can go build a shed door for him or whatever. I don't know. In your transition, and if that was.
Yeah, I just think that, you know, anyway, I guess for our career, our work, it's always looking back at historic precedent. And luckily for us, there's nothing like that available in our market. So we're able to build and do doors that might be a little bit more common around here, but aren't common in Texas. Mm-hmm. And it's been a point of difference for us. It's been a big opportunity and you know, growth place for us because we're building things that other people aren't.
It's hard to tell too what people are and aren't building out here because I feel like the circles that we are in is North Bennett, right? Yeah. And so everyone we talk to, everyone we're asking, they're out there doing the stuff that you're doing, and hopefully one day I'll get to do. But the house we live in has a, you know, it's not a nice home. It would benefit from a nice door on it. It would benefit from some of these cool things. And, you know, just looking at the real estate market here, people have the money to afford stuff like that on these homes that they're spending multiple millions of dollars on for much less than that.
And how do you tell them their taste is awful, you know?
Well, maybe not like that.
You don't. Yeah, you don't.
How often do you run into someone who just has terrible taste?
Well, we end up, it's pretty clear pretty early that we're not going to work together. I was talking to a guy up in Southlake. He wanted to build a big house. I want to build a big house, and it's going to be awesome. And I go, do you have an architect? No, I figure I'm going to be able to design it myself.
Yeah, it's a good call.
Already, I'm just done with this dude. And I kind of got a little bit obstinate with him. I go, well, you don't want to do that, do you? Something I'd never say to someone normally. And I could tell it pricked his, like, what do you mean? Why wouldn't I want to do that? And I knew it wasn't going to go anywhere. So, but that's how I get rid of guys like that. I'm not going to work with this guy. You know, some guy who, there's a lot of rich guys out there, money isn't the obstacle, who yeah. think they know more than everybody. Mm. And those guys are hard to work with and work for, because they're the smartest guy in the room. And okay. Let me tell you.
Sure, yeah. sure. Yeah. I have the money, just you're
yeah.
building it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look what I've done in my career. I know more than everybody here.
Yeah. What did Steve say? The more money you have, you know.
I don't remember.
So it was approximated. People with money still have bad taste.
Yeah,
something like that. I don't want to misquote him, but it was like
something like the more money you have, it doesn't account for taste or something. Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Exactly. They still make awful decisions. Yeah.
Seems there's an interior designer quote that's basically, I wish my rich friends had the taste of my poor friends.
Yeah.
And you know, just that they
might be some truth in that. That is
they funny. Can't afford. You know, I wish these wealthy people had taste so we could do some of these great things, but it's hard to do. Mm. So, but you got to be an educator.
Yeah,
maybe my takeaway from you: you got to be able to explain what you're doing, and then using the past to encourage people to build better. I think it's.
Yeah.
The path.
Yeah, and this is a great place for that. Everything that
100%
from the hand tools on so far.
Yeah.
You know, you've said it before, learning to build from the past. I mean, it is seriously making us better builders. It's
really
like
100%.
just the way you're thinking about stuff. If you can build something from the past using either the joinery or the layout techniques, anything, there's not anything you can build today because you're just plugging in technology.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Just using more modern materials, right?
Yeah.
You know, casework using sheet goods instead of gluing up panels, but you know, essentially, if you can do something from then, you can do it today. And so, it's been a great challenge.
Mm-hmm.
How big is your shop?
Oh, well, 300 square feet.
Small. So it's a garage kind of thing.
It's honestly, yeah. It's.
What tools do you have in there?
So
shaper, table saw.
Yeah, we got a table saw. I have a. The old Hussey molder from 1940, no infeed and outfeed. It's all manual, which, by the way, I hear is great for really tight radius because you can feed it at a really slow rate. But also, if you're producing moldings from the past and you don't want to have the knife marks on them, you can really slow down the feed rate and keep those knife marks,
mill marks,
the mill marks really close together so they're virtually non-detectable. Cool stuff like that. So, yeah, a little shaper, you know, lathe, big lathe, and... planer, joiner, shaper.
What are they on wheels so you can move them around?
No. But everything's essentially works. The outfeed table is the infeed table of the next machine in a way. And so, right, like the table saw is in between, you know, limited space. And so if I have anything over an 8-foot board to cut, maybe 7 feet, I have a small table saw that I wheel out of storage and I can do long moldings on that.
Nice.
Yeah, a bench on wheels that acts as an assembly table, radial arm saw, miter saw that I actually do for the angled cuts. The radial arm saw is fixed at 90. You know, a mortiser.
You got a lot of tools for 300 square feet.
You should see it, Jackson. I think you should come up. I want you to take a look at it. Just to see the old. It's actually a heck of a building that it's in too. It's not just an industrial warehouse. It's 5 floors of craftspeople and artists and
cool.
all kinds of cool stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
But. It's somehow it works.
Is Lolo Mill Milltown?
It is, yeah.
On a river?
It is, yeah. Okay. Industrial, old industrial town.
The building's awesome.
A lot of good history there. Yeah, I wish Lowell, if you're listening, allocate better funding towards your architecture and preservation. Because they really have something special, and it's not appreciated, I don't think. So, you know, but that's all right. Anything else tying into the school or?
Nah, man, whatever you want.
Step one, maybe we'll come up and do it at next year this time, kind of see how you've grown, see how you've changed. It'd be fun to.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I think your trajectory, I think a lot of probably listeners are are wrestling with the same things you're going through. So I think that it would be good for you, them to hear.
Well, I mean, Kevin, thanks for being a guest.
Yeah,
and
appreciate
for coming out, opening up about your experience and your everything.
Yeah.
We didn't get into the, you were a dog sled driver for a while. We didn't get into some of the fun stuff.
No, but, totally irrelevant from what we're here for.
Fellow Knowles guy. So we had some fun stuff. Anyway, really appreciate you being a guest. Really appreciate getting to talk with you. And,
thank you guys for having me. This is incredible. Yeah. A true pleasure.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, great.
Well, awesome. Thank you guys for watching, and we'll see you in the next episode.